Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey everybody, Pascal here. We are back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption. And today, I'm blessed to have Brent Cooper here. Brent is an incredible human being, is a New York Times bestselling author of a book called The Lean Entrepreneur, recently wrote a new book as a follow-up called Disruption Proof, Empower People, Create Value, Drive Change. As you can imagine, that fits unbelievably well to what we typically talk about here in the podcast. So we'll dig deep into this book. He's also the CEO and founder of Moves the Needle, has a long career in the startup and large enterprise world behind him, and is also a avid surfer. If you read the book, you will know what I mean. With that being said, Brent, I'm excited to have you on this podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Pascal. Happy to be here.
So, Brent, I have to ask, I love the book. I love the fact that you're taking a different perspective on this whole topic of disruption. If you wouldn't mind telling us and the listeners a little bit, where do you come from when it comes to innovation and disruption? What's your starting point, your base?
Well, to be honest, I think my starting point is the same as everybody's starting point, which is usually, you know, Clayton Christensen's analysis of the tech industry and in the 80s and 90s and maybe the 2000s, maybe going back before that, I don't know. And sort of his concepts around the innovator's dilemma and this pattern that he saw where industries are completely disrupted by new companies. So that's where I began. And I think that, you know, I come from the startup world. And so we were always the ones that were trying to disrupt whole industries if we could to really change the world. I mean, we really believe that's what we were set out to do. And there are certain periods in history where new things come along. And at that time, it's the internet and all of the technologies that were evolving very rapidly in the broad understanding of the internet. And there was this opportunity to redo whole industries. And the first startup I was in was called Tumbleweed. Basically, we had technology to send emails or documents securely over the internet. And we thought we could replace overnight packages and those type of things, as long as they were documents, like the way law firms communicated. It was an exciting time. I think that those opportunities now are far and few between. I don't think it's the same as it was then. Disruptive innovation time. I think we're in a different time now.
So curious to hear, if you wouldn't mind, I would love to stay in this particular piece a little longer, because I find it striking that you say this when seemingly, at least, the whole world tells you, oh my God, AI is changing. Everything is the biggest disruption we've seen since the invention of the microprocessor and the personal computer. So it sounds like you have a little bit of a different perspective here.
Well, I think that there are still emerging technologies that can be disruptive to society, and they can be disruptive to how businesses are accomplishing their mission. But there's no really one firm that is taking over a completely existing market in AI, right? So it's a disruptive technology, but it doesn't meet any of the criteria of the way Dr. Christensen would have defined disruptive innovation. And gotcha. I think it would be, you'd be hard pressed to think of actually the last industry that went through classic disruptive innovation. I just don't think it happens anymore. We're not going through that cycle of tech. And in the end, I think that if you look back, he was probably only describing a small portion of the economy. And it wasn't necessarily something that prevailed in all businesses or all industries. And there's quite a few people out there now that have done sort of the research and say, yeah, you know, listen, the likelihood, even with emerging technology, the likelihood of a startup completely disrupting a new market, it's like really teeny. And yet all of the innovation groups of these large companies continue to waltz around with their innovator's dilemma, you know, in their backpack and talk about breakthrough innovation. All of these concepts are anachronistic in this day and age, to be honest. If I think innovators need to be thinking about their contributions differently, not in a lab trying to come up with breakthrough innovation. Not only are they not going to be able to do it, it's impossible to do it that way, but also I don't think that they need to.
So with that refreshing perspective, and I love it, as a base, if you are the CEO, the chief innovation officer, whatever C-suite title or VP title you have at a large corporation, what are you going to do? What do we make out of this?
It's to be honest, it's like any technology adoption. So, you know, not long after college, I sort of became the computer guy, or, you know, we didn't even call it IT yet, because I was the one that studied computer programming in college and was familiar with computers. And you would go into these young, small businesses, medium-sized businesses that were just adopting laptops or desktop computers or electronic email and networking technologies were just sort of emerging and catching hold in these businesses. Well, so all of those CEOs are doing sort of a very similar ROI calculation in that moment. So this is the 90s. And they're saying, listen, if we go and buy all of our principals these $2,000 or $3,000 laptops, what is the return on investment we're going to get? Well, we can fire one personal admin, you know, that like a group of four partners have four admins and we can get rid of two of them or something like that. So they're doing an ROI calculation, which of course is also eliminating jobs, which is also the big fear of AI. Oh, it's going to eliminate all these jobs. But what you're actually trying to do is use the technology to make those principals more efficient. And so that they're actually able to generate more revenue themselves at a lower cost and faster than they were before. But I tell you, even in those days, those early 90s days, it was tough ROI calculation. These businesses were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every year or every 2 years because the technology life cycle was so short, because the software would be too powerful that would slow the computers down and the chips would have just doubled in speed. And so you have to like upgrade all of your computers. And it was this whole game of upgrading to try to chase this ROI. And so again, it's not really that different. AI has a different potential and it's less well understood and its application is less well understood. It touches more people. And so I think that there's some scary elements in there to people, but at its very base, it's still the same sort of thing. And this is the way executives should be approaching it. How might we apply AI in order to achieve our mission more efficiently, not just reduce costs, but achieve our mission more efficiently? And then as a boss, we should be saying, how can we use AI to automate the more mundane tasks that I do or my people do? And then how do I up-level the skills of my people so that they are actually driving a big impact? So the growth mindset is, how do I leverage AI to reduce the redundancy and reduce the mundane, which is what AI is very good at? How do I actually draw out the creativity and the intelligence and these other things out of my employees so that they are actually having a greater effect on the impact in the business? And so then if you're successful at that, you end up creating more jobs than you're shedding. And that's actually what should be the promise of AI, is that if used correctly, we're actually going to have this growth mindset and we're going to figure out new things and we're going to be creating more jobs than the ones that we're shedding. And that is a good outcome for technology. And to be honest, it's always been that. Right. And so I think AI, there's sort of the fear is a little bit overblown. And I think it's because it's suddenly all of these white collar people are fearing for their jobs. And it's way overstated, because AI does the creativity and the intelligence and all of that stuff actually very poorly. What it does very well is looking at large language models and copying what's already out there. AI, the large language models that are built on the internet, reinforce mediocrity and conventional wisdom. And so if you are above mediocrity and you have some ideas that go by, and that's what people should be thinking about is, oh no, I'm going to lose my job. Well, you're only going to lose your job as if you have none of your own creativity and intelligence to bring to the job.
Right. Curious to talk about this in the context of disruption, and you very astutely titled your book Disruption Proof. Can you walk us through a little bit, and you've got frameworks in your book, of course, and can you walk us a little bit through as an executive, as a founder, how do I prove myself for disruption? How do I actually go about this?
Right. So it's important that to understand that in this context, I'm not talking about disruption as being just brought by technology. Technology is certainly a part of it. But again, it's not, oh, I'm scared this startup is going to take my business. It could be anybody that's actually going to take my business. So if I don't move on this new technology, other people might go after my customers because I'm being left behind. Okay, so that's true. Technology can disrupt that way. But it's also things like the pandemic. It's supply chain being blocked. Or remember, even before the pandemic, the ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal. And so suddenly everybody's non-redundant supply chains got affected, right? And it could be inflation. It could be the big quit. It could be any economic changes. So these things have always happened. They just happen in isolation. Pandemics have happened before. But it's this globally connected world that we're living in because of the digital age. And it's the speed of information and the speed of disinformation. All of these things mean that those disruptive things that used to be isolated now ripple across all of our economies and all of our businesses, right? So it's something that literally does happen. The butterfly in the Amazon actually is affecting us. And so that's sort of this new paradigm that executives have to be thinking of, is that, no, we're not done. We didn't make it through the pandemic and now we can go back to the way it was before. We actually have to prepare our organizations for the next disruption. Maybe it's going to be a ransomware attack. That actually hit a hospital here in San Diego during the pandemic. And I just was talking to a rural healthcare provider yesterday, and a local hospital system there is being shut down because of a ransomware attack. They just couldn't afford to get beyond that attack. And so, again, that's another type of disruption. So how do I create organizations that can thrive and survive these ongoing disruptions? And that's sort of the big question. And there's a number of things that executives can do or should start doing that can start preparing those organizations to be able to be aware of those disruptions that are coming, to be able to respond and change what you're doing based upon those things coming, and have the strength to be able to withstand those. And so that's really where the acronym RAD comes from, the resilient, they're aware, and they're dynamic. They have this strength of their founding or their DNA or their intellectual property or something that is core to them that is like, you know, the roots of a palm tree that go deep into the shoreline. Yet they're also aware of the storms coming and they can dynamically change. They can blow in the wind without collapsing when these changes do come. You can't prevent the changes. They're coming. So how do we prepare for them as an organization?
I'd be curious to talk a little bit more about the dynamic part of this, because at least in my practice, a lot of organizations seem to really conceptually understand it without a doubt. I mean, there's the agile movement. Everybody talks about agility and adaptability. And yet it seems to be incredibly hard for organizations to actually pull off. I'd be curious to hear from your experience, as you're writing also in the book about, how do you do this as an organization?
Yeah, it is very difficult. And I think that agile is one example of a good way to go. I think that the problem often is that people are more focused on the processes of agile as opposed to the behavior that's needed to be agile. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I think that there's these large top-down implementations, process-heavy implementations of agile that completely forego the principles that were first outlined in the Agile Manifesto. And I think the Agile Manifesto should be like right there in your hip pocket, no matter what you're implementing, because you want to get back to what those core principles are. And so that has a lot to do with empowering teams to be able to do their own work in service to what the mission of that team is. And that's still very difficult for leadership to do and to understand. And to be honest, employees don't even know how to act in an empowered fashion. So there's a part of the book where the leader is saying, you know, how come I can't just say go be agile and my employees go be agile, right? And mm-hmm. as opposed to, wait a second, you actually have to teach the skills. You actually have to work with them so that they understand what it means to be empowered. You actually hold them accountable in different mm-hmm. ways. You can't have empowerment without accountability. And it requires this change behavior, not only of all of the team members, but also of the middle managers and of the senior managers. And those changes, you don't get those from reading a book, and you don't get those from being told how to do. You actually have to practice the behavior. And when we're engaged in a large way with a large organization, we'll spend 90 days with five teams of 10 people and different layers of management, and we'll have that group practice that new behavior for 90 days. And after the 90 days, we might have to hang around a little bit to help them, but they can start acting in that way. And now you've got this beachhead inside of your company that is agile. And then you have to start working from there. How do you begin to proselytize other parts of the organization to work in the same way? It's a long journey. It's a long right. journey, and it's difficult. But I think that the alternative is, just as you said, you're not prepared and you have all of these disruptions that come in, and you're going to turn over your C-suite every 5 years, and you're going to go acquire companies, and you're going to divest these mm-hmm. companies, and you're going to do reorg after reorg. And, you know, I think that that's a slow sink to ultimately failing completely.
In this context, where do you typically, when you engage with an organization, where do you typically have them start? Like, what's the starting point for that journey for you?
Yeah, it kind of depends on who's bringing us in. In the last case with the medical device company, it was their digital group. And they had already bought into the digital transformation. They have all this opportunity digitizing their products in ways, IoT, eventually AI. And they have no shortage of ideas. This is why everybody that does idea challenges, it's a waste of time. There's no shortage of ideas. It's really, how do you generate the evidence that these ideas are any good? And then that's what we're mm-hmm. teaching them. So we go in there, they've got these ideas. We've got five teams. You know, the teams are essentially the two pizza-sized teams, 5 to 10 people. And we're teaching them how to go out and talk to customers, how to run experiments to bust through your assumptions, how to use evidence to help make your decisions, how do you share that information with leaders, how do leaders respond to people that are working in this exploration style of working, and then how do you balance the execution and the exploration? It's like, once you've learned something, you don't continue to explore, you actually have to start executing. And everything mm-hmm. has to be this balance between exploration and execution. And that's what we're teaching those. We have it's very hands-on, intensive coaching that we're doing over 90 days.
So interesting. Curious to hear, and this goes, of course, for everybody who reads the book, you've got this beautiful alliteration of 5 E's. Which speak to exactly what you just described. I'd be curious to hear kind of like the anti-pattern, like the when you see this not working, like have you seen any patterns where it's like, this is where I feel companies trip over their own 2 feet on a regular basis?
Well, yeah, I think, to be honest, this isn't for everybody. So there, you do find there are people inside the organization that just cannot or will not or don't want to work this way. And that's fine. I think that there are places in the organization for those people to be. And so it's good for you to sort of learn. We typically have rates of over 90% of these employees that never want to go back to the way they were working before. Yeah. because it's exercising their creativity and their intelligence in ways that they weren't before. They get to be solving problems. They feel like they're driving impact, not only for their team and their group, but also for the whole company. And it becomes powerful. And I think it's important to note that in this age of burnout and the big quit and all of these things where people are frustrated with their work, and all sorts of studies that say that employees want to feel in line. They want to work with ethical companies. They want their companies to be more sustainable and more diverse. I mean, the people want this. And so if you start empowering them to work in these new ways, those are the people that you're going to be able to keep and that you're going to want to keep. I think that the tripping point tends to be leaders who don't really understand this concept of empowering, but also holding accountable. And sometimes they step away too far and you have to kind of teach them to come back in and ask the right questions. Or other times there's a culture of, there's such a culture of respect that there's no, what Brené Brown would call respectful rumbling. There's no sort of open, direct dialogue about what should be done or what's wrong. You can't like critique another person's ideas because that's disrespectful or something. As opposed to learning how to do that in a respectful way, you can't just let everything slide. There are these cultural elements that sort of have to be worked through that are often difficult to overcome. But primarily, I think that middle management doesn't get much investment inside of these large organizations, and they don't get the training that they need. And they probably were never trained to begin with. They moved up somebody from a team member to a manager. They didn't get any training, and these people are great at the technical abilities that they have, but maybe not great managers. I do think you just have to invest time in developing the skills of these people, because when people are working in this uncertainty mode, you can't just tell them to work harder. You can't just be like squeezing the blood out of the turnip. You can't just like, come on, let's go do it. It's not just rah-rah. You actually have to demonstrate your own vulnerability. You have to admit what you don't know. You have to identify your own assumptions as such. And you have to find new ways of holding them accountable. Hold people accountable just to the tasks that they're doing and then the outcomes. You actually have to have a way to measure the progress towards the outcomes. And so we help with that as well. But it's, again, it's difficult. It's a new world. And I think a lot of the schools, and this is MBA primarily, are still teaching these old ways that we don't have a lot of people that are naturally adept at this, though I think that, you know, younger people, I think, are just sort of more naturally entrepreneurial. I do think that some of this comes to them a little bit easier.
You mentioned multiple times now, this takes time. You know, it's like, it's not a short road, it takes time, it's hard to do. If you look at a transformational process overall, so not just the little bit of like, hey, we're like engaging, you know, like an initiative and it's out there. But really, if you're thinking about an incumbent organization truly moving the needle, moving from where they are today to become a RAD organization, as you like to call it, how much time do you think that takes, or is your experience?
Five plus years.
Right.
But it drives impact a lot faster than that. And so I think that's actually the thing to hang on, because the old school way of innovating, you could still only get your ROI 5-10 years down the road, if at all. And and you would get no progress towards that impact. It would be all sort of all or none. And what you can find here is that you could start easy. You have to start small, but you can start driving impact really from the very beginning, from the very get-go, and change the company in a positive way. And it takes a brave organization to do that. But there are all sorts of business issues inside the company, not even customer facing stuff yet. Just the way groups are getting along, the way leaderships are getting along, the siloed natures, the old IT or old HR practices or old financial practices. There's all of these inefficiencies and these bottlenecks inside the organization. And you could start working on those challenges at any point, and you could see an impact, a major impact within a year. But again, it takes the visionary leader to be able to see that that's actually going to not only prove that you have the people to do it, but also that it's going to improve these outcomes.
How do you deal with an organization where you feel like the leader isn't bought in?
I don't know. I that one's tough. I mean, there are still grassroots ways of getting going, but you're doing it in a way in order to change that leader's mind. Ultimately, yeah. You can only get so far if you can't change the leader's mind. But if you're in a large organization, there are a lot of people that are thinking about it like you are. And so you need to form a community with others that think the same way. And you'll find that they actually include some leaders. And so this innovation community or transformation community needs to find places where they can practice their craft, where they can run experiments that will drive impact. And then the moment you drive a little bit of impact, you can start shining a light on the way it works. And then that might get more positive attention. So there are ways of doing it kind of bottoms up from the grassroots level. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, if the leadership doesn't buy, then it can only go so far.
I'd be curious to hear your perspective. In the book, you talk quite a bit about diversity and diversity of thought and, you know, like diverse teams, et cetera. Clearly, it's a topic du jour, like everybody talks about it. But I think in many cases, it's very lip service-y. I'd be curious to hear, like, what's your perspective on this? And why do you think it's so crucial that you actually spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about it?
Yeah, well, I think that it's well known, or at least it's been established pretty persuasively, that a diversity of thinking solves complexity better than a lack of diversity. It seems rather obvious. I mean, if you've got 10 very like-minded people trying to solve a complex problem, you're actually looking at it from a very limited number of angles. So forgetting about what we even mean by, forget about the skin color and sort of all of these other ways of looking at diversity. Thinking about diversity in terms of the way people approach problems, which is influenced by their background, where they come from, culture, education, their experiences, all of these things that allow people to come to a problem from a different perspective. They all share, even in a diverse environment, they share the same need, but not the same need is going to be addressed, which is an important distinction. So if you just think about diversity in this way, you need to not only have products that solve for needs, address needs in a diverse way that expands your market, but also just getting people to tackle how to address a need or whatever, sort of the problem solving space. If it's a complex problem, which is really brought on by a complex market, then diversity just fundamentally will solve the problem better. There's been like a famous study that showed that, you know, physicists called in chemists to solve a physics problem because they just needed smart people that had this diversity of thinking. I think we live in a more complex world. Again, the global interconnectedness, the sort of the level of niche markets, people are able to demand different products, different features, different ways that they're going to be delivered, different prices, different business models. It's the where we are in the industrial revolution. If you think about the sort of the polar sides, the Model T car that represented sort of the beginning of the real industrial age, you can have any car you want, Model T, and you want as long as it was black. And then if you think about on the other end of the spectrum, digital fabrication where people could print whatever it is that they want on demand. Think of a pair of sneakers and whatever choices that you want and colors and styles and materials, you could do it like really literally right at the moment you want it. That's this polar opposite. We've went from a very simple world in that regard to a very complex world. Diversity helps you inside that complex world. Now, it just so happens that skin color, where you're born, culture, economic background is a proxy for diversity. I think that it's completely reasonable to me that when I look around a room, I want to see the diversity because I believe that that will represent the type of diverse thinking that I need in order to better serve my mission. It isn't charity. And part of the problem is that people that are sort of fight against this are all about meritocracy. But the thing is that meritocracy is not the only thing that you want in deciding who's going to work on stuff. Meritocracy is like a minimum viable product, right? Mm-hmm. Meritocracy is a line. It's not a continuum. So if somebody actually scores something on a test, 640, and that line has been determined, that person can adequately do the job that we want done, then somebody that is 740 isn't actually more qualified for that job than somebody is 640. They're equally qualified because it's a line. It's not a threat. It's a threshold, mm-hmm. not a continuum. Mm-hmm. And so people get hung up on, well, what about the 740? It's like, no, I want somebody at 640, and then I want these other qualities that bring me the diversity.
I like that.
And so the way that the people that are anti this, they don't understand that they're defining what is needed based upon one variable that they like. And then they define how that variable should be used. And it's like, no, that's BS. That's not the way it works.
I love that. Brent, this is an incredible conversation. I absolutely love where we're going with this and the diversity of your thought here. I want to add one more diverse layer to it before we wrap, which is you mentioned in the very beginning, and I mentioned this very briefly also in my intro, you have an extensive background in the startup world. And when we talked about the disruptive impact of AI at the very beginning, you also mentioned, you know, maybe startups, the opportunity for startups to really be industry defining might be gone. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on what do you think is the role of the large enterprise and the startup in, like, is this like a rivalry? Is it a symbiotic relationship? And if it's a symbiotic relationship, how do you think enterprises can best engage with the other side of the coin, which is the startup community?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I am pro antitrust. I think that we've really let markets consolidate in a dangerous way that actually reflects in lower wages and lower quality products and a lack of innovation and all of these things. We shouldn't have let all of these companies consolidate markets. It bothers me a little bit if part of the reason why there's no IPOs and maybe that there's no disruption in some areas. I still think that there's a possibility of disruption, especially in healthcare, in life sciences, but because there's still invention going on there. And so I think that all of the acquisitions that we allow is a way for corporates to actually squelch new technology, which used to be antitrust, that used to be illegal and hopefully will become illegal again. We need to open up this so that those new technologies see the light of day and then actually can improve people's lives again. That's really what the promise of capitalism is, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that just sort of blindly allowing all of this consolidation and acquisition is wrong and it's hurtful. That being said, there are large enterprises that can benefit, like they own distribution or they own this other capabilities that it's very difficult for a startup to achieve. And in that way, large corporations acquiring companies that fit into their existing distribution models is perhaps okay. Partnering with those companies. So there's the example in the book of 3Com that partnered with a startup in order to bring new solar technology to market. And that was relying somewhat on the IP of the startup, but also IP that 3M engineers had developed. And so to me, that seems like a cool partnership. I think venture capitaling, large companies investing in startups is a good idea. And there's a lot of ways for the big established companies to work with the startup world. I don't think large companies who are not in the IP game, in other words, they're not inventing new technology. Those companies are different. They need to continue to invent. But if you're not an invention company, then you can't do breakthrough innovation. You can't do it. And so establishing a lab or all of these playgrounds for people to pretend that they're going to reinvent a new business model or something, it's just, they can play with the business model canvas as long as they want, and they're never going to do breakthrough innovation. They really aren't. And yet, so if those companies actually are involved in tech scouting, in startup scouting, in investing in startups, in being actively participants in the greater innovation economy, hosting events, sponsoring events. And they start finding the startups that have figured stuff out that would be a benefit to the market that the large company is in. Mm-hmm. That seems like a way to do long-term, quote unquote, innovation, because the market is out there establishing thousands of startups that are giving a thousands of different experiments and a try. That's where success is going to come from, not the five that's in the corporate innovation lab. The responsibility of that innovation people that are inside of these corporates is actually to be involved in the startup community. And that it could include investment, it could include future acquisition. And then that just seems like such a logical and rational way of doing it. I just think that that's the way it should work.
Absolutely phenomenal conversation. I love those last comments on really thinking through how do you actually engage as a enterprise, a larger enterprise with the startup community. Really thought-provoking and provocative. As a last question I have for you, of course, we will put the link to your book and your website into the show notes. But just generally speaking, if people are curious about Brand Cooper, the work you're doing, the information you're putting out there, where can they find you? What is a good place for them to start?
Well, I mean, if any of the services that we talked about are of interest, or you might know of companies that might be interested, we can pass on a referral fee for that. But you can go check out movestheneedle.com. Mm-hmm. I'm at brantcooper.com. I'm all over LinkedIn. So I encourage you to reach out and connect with me. And if you want, you can send me an email at brant@brantcooper.com. But I'm doing regular live events and regular discussions on LinkedIn. And if people want to challenge me or want to discuss any of this, I'm really happy to be engaged with anybody from your audience.
Wonderful. Brant, this was a phenomenal conversation. Once again, thank you so much for making the time. I do hope you get out there and surf a little bit. It is a sweltering 100 Fahrenheit here in landlocked Colorado. So I sometimes very much wish I get back to the beach I had when I lived in California. But for us, the escape is the mountain. So thank you so much. It was really, really phenomenal.
Yeah, good talking to you, Pascal. Thanks so much.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.